Today, we are indeed appreciative and delighted to have David Pyle, who is chaplain in training, first lieutenant in the United States Army, and a student at our seminary in Chicago, Meadville Lombard Theological Seminary. And whatever way you perceive the way in which our universe moves and events happen, there was a terrible tragedy at Fort Wood in Texas this past week, and chaplains are going to be a part of that community's grieving process for a long time. And David is going to be addressing some of those issues that are going to be coming from that horrific event. I'd like to just acknowledge that David represents a long tradition in our Unitarian Universalist movement. Just suffice to say that General George Washington, during the Revolutionary War, chose as his chief chaplain John Murray, who was our founder of the Universalist tradition in America. And he did that with great peril, because Universalism was not, as it is still today, not considered the orthodox way of practicing your faith. So we have a long and honorable tradition of service in the military as Unitarian Universalists. Let us open as a responsive reading this morning words adapted from a quote by General Omar Bradley. General Bradley was one of those generals who led the Allied forces in Europe during the Second World War. I will begin with these words. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. Ours is a world that knows more about killing than we know about living.
For our world has grasped the mystery of the atom and forgotten the Sermon on the Mount.
The path and journey that David Pyle, our speaker this morning, has taken is worth sharing a little bit, and I found this in our UU World article that was printed a few years back. David was raised by a military family in Tennessee, and following the family tradition, enrolled in ROTC while he was in high school. Another element of David's upbringing was his Southern Baptist religion. However, that soon fell away. By his first year in the military, David no longer identified himself as a, quote, Christian, and he soon found himself radically unchurched. A 1997 incident while he was serving in Bosnia instilled a new conviction in David. It was a deep opposition to religious hatred and intolerance. This resolution ultimately led him to find a home in Unitarian Universalism, a religion whose pluralism, inclusiveness, tolerance he valued. After 5 years of active duty and three in the reserves, David earned a college degree in 2001 and began working as a church administrator and student minister at the UU Fellowship in Galveston County, Galveston, Texas. And when the United States invaded Iraq in March of 2003, David faced a crisis. Deeply ambivalent about the invasion, he remembers a feeling of failure at seeing it happen. And then at the same time, he felt guilt for not being with the young men and women he had trained with and with whom he himself had served. And that sense that he was somehow betraying those comrades, fellow service members, convinced David to re-enlist. Yet over the next year and a half, through dialogue with the congregation in Galveston, David realized that he could no longer return as a combat soldier. He said, "My personal faith had evolved to the point that I could no longer personally carry a weapon." And in particular, David felt that he couldn't actively affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person while engaging in combat. He said that that's not my view of how I want to be. I don't want to see myself as someone who would take someone else's life. And then, as he was working as an administrator with the congregation in Galveston, they began working on him. And they began to push him up. And he began to reconsider what was happening within him. And he responded by acknowledging the encouragement of the congregation in Galveston. And that is how many who have found themselves to choose to serve as ministers in our movement have answered a call. It's not something only within, but it's usually from the community that you're part of. That happened to me when I was a member of the Towson Unitarian Universalist congregation. They were fairly insistent that I needed to go forward in this role of minister. David responded to the Galveston congregation, enrolled at Meadville Lombard, still a student there today. He served as the student intern at the Evanston Unitarian Church, where I met David. And after meeting him, I said to myself, we've got to get David to come to Prairie. And finally, we have him here, and how poignant that he's here to address some of the concerns and issues arising out of how we care for those in the military and the service requirement, that we don't have to favor war, but we need to extend our care for those who serve, not only the individual service members, but their families. And that is being energized today by the Church of the Larger Fellowship that has reinstituted their ministry to those in uniform. And there's a whole lot that you can learn about that on the Church of the Larger Fellowship website. So it's indeed a pleasure and an honor for me to introduce David Pyle, and we look now forward to your remarks. Thank you, David, for coming.
Good morning. I was just telling Ralph, I don't know if I've ever heard anyone else say my call narrative before. That's new to me. I'd like to begin this morning with a reading. Some of you may be familiar with a poem entitled "The Charge of the Light Brigade." Many of us had to read it in school. But what you may not know is that there is a part two. a poem entitled The Last of the Light Brigade by Rudyard Kipling. There were 30 million English who talked of England's might. There were 20 broken troopers who lacked a bed for the night. They had neither food nor money. They had neither service nor trade. They were only shiftless soldiers, the last of the Light Brigade. They felt that life was fleeting. They knew that art was not long. That though they were dying of famine, they lived in deathless song. They asked for a little money to keep the wolf from the door, and the 30 million English sent only 20 pounds and four. They laid their heads together. They were scarred and lined in gray. Keen were the Russian sabers, but want was keener than they. And an old troop sergeant muttered, "Let's go to the man who writes. The things on baklava, the kiddies at school recites." They went without bands or colors, a regiment 10 file strong, to look for the master singer who'd crowned them all in his song. And waiting his servant's order, by the garden gate they stayed, a desolate little cluster, the last of the Light Brigade. They strove to stand to attention, to straighten the toil-bowed back. They drilled on an empty stomach. The loose-knit files fell slack. With stooping of weary soldiers in garments tattered and frayed, they shambled into his presence, the last of the Light Brigade. The old troop sergeant was spokesman. He said, "Begging your pardon, sir, you wrote, O the Light Brigade, here's all that isn't dead. And it's all come true what you wrote, sir, regarding the mouth of hell, for we're all nigh to the workhouse, and we thought we'd call and tell. No, thank you, we don't want food, sir, but could you take and write a sort of to be continued and see the next page of the fight? We think that someone has blundered, and couldn't you tell him how? You wrote once we were heroes, sir. Please write that we are starving now." The poor little army departed, limping and lean and forlorn. And the heart of the master singer grew hot with the scorn of scorn. And he wrote for them wonderful verses that swept the land like a flame, till the fatted souls of the English were scourged with the thing called shame. O 30 million English that babble of England's might, behold, there are 20 heroes who lack for their food tonight. Our children's children are lisping to honor the charge they made, and we leave to the streets and the workhouse the last of the Light Brigade. Two and a half years ago, I had the honor and privilege to attend the retirement ceremony of the senior military chaplain of our Unitarian Universalist faith, Chaplain Colonel the Reverend Vernon Chandler. After over 32 years as a military chaplain, with time in Bosnia, Kosovo, and in Iraq, this man of peace, Chaplain Chandler, was hanging up his uniform and committing himself full-time to his work as a sexual assault crisis counselor and program director in Germany. He's responsible for counseling those who are raped in Iraq and Afghanistan. Vernon Chandler and I had met once before, briefly, when I was a young sergeant at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. In fact, as far as I can remember, he is the first person to ever say the words Unitarian Universalism to me. It was an honor for me to be there at his retirement ceremony, to salute him and let him know that even in his absence, there will be others to carry the presence and saving message of our liberal faith tradition in the U.S. Army chaplaincy. as Chaplain George Tiger and I were standing in the hot South Carolina sun, the band began playing a traditional song whose lyrics said, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away." I remember thinking, "God, I hope not." Vernon has been a friend and mentor for me these last few years. I hope he neither dies nor fades away, at least not anytime soon. As I watched Vernon walk with that senior officer on an inspection of the troops that were assembled, it struck me how much wishful thinking is built into that phrase. It would be so convenient if those that we sent off to war returned home and just faded away. It would be so convenient if those we sent off to war returned home and easily re-entered society, found nice productive jobs, and were able to lock the war-torn experience of their lives neatly away. It would be so convenient. But absolutely nothing about war is ever convenient, including how you come home from it. I believe that we have only begun to see the true cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a cost not just in dollars or higher taxes, a cost not just in lives lost, a cost not just in the loss of American prestige and stature around the world, a cost not just in families, temporarily or even permanently separated, but a cost that will be measured out for decades to come in the lives of our veterans and indeed in the lives of us all. No matter how convenient it might be for some if our veterans just faded away, they won't. Whether we supported the causes and campaigns that the politicians we elected sent our soldiers on, our sailors on, our airmen on, our Marines on, their service demands of all of us that we care for them and their families as they recover from the trauma, dare I say it, the hell of war. I know that behind this idea lies a very hard thought for many of us who are Unitarian Universalists. It would be so easy for some of us to hold up our hands and say, "Not my war. I didn't support it. I didn't vote for the politicians who sent them. Let those who did pay for the care of our veterans." It would be so easy, and it would be wrong. For no matter who issued the orders, those soldiers thought that they were sent by we the people. And we are those people. It's a hard thought, I know. I live in a rather liberal area of Chicago known as Hyde Park. Anybody familiar with it? For those of you who have been there, you know that it is the home neighborhood of the University of Chicago, of the Oriental Museum, of our nation's top-rated documentary theater. And we've got a pretty famous neighbor just down the street, in the president. It is an area where students attend lectures almost every night on global warming, on ending the war, on addressing poverty at home and abroad. Most of those who live in Hyde Park are students or professors or university staff, many of them in their late teens and early 20s. It strikes me that that's the same age group that generally joins the military, although not the same class. A few blocks north, a few blocks south, or a few blocks west of Hyde Park, and you are deep into the south side of Chicago, into neighborhoods not as economically advantaged or racially integrated as Hyde Park happens to be. Hyde Park is indeed an island of wealth and privilege surrounded by some of the worst urban poverty in the United States of America. Young women and men in those neighborhoods around Hyde Park often do join the military to escape, or possibly to earn enough money to attend a state college. About 2 years ago, I was asked by a fellow seminary student to preside over the ceremony that swore him into the United States Army as a new chaplain candidate and a second lieutenant. The place of the ceremony, our Unitarian Universalist Seminary, was about 5 blocks from my apartment. It's a route that I've walked countless times, as you can probably imagine. On this particular day, however, I was walking that route through the heart of the University of Chicago in my U.S. Army dress uniform. As I walked across campus, I noticed something amazing. People would look up, see my uniform with all the medals and airborne wings and shiny little buttons and devices, what the Reverend Barbara Peskin calls my tribal markings. They would look up and they would see all those things on my uniform, and then they would quickly avert their eyes. When I walk across campus in my civilian clothes, people meet my gaze and sometimes even say hello. It's the nice part of Chicago. But not this day. It was almost painfully obvious how their eyes would suddenly become locked on my uniform, and then they would suddenly and quickly become fascinated by the sidewalk, or the grass, or the clouds, or whatever book they happened to be carrying at the time. If the compulsion is that strong to avert our eyes from a healthy soldier in uniform, how strong will that compulsion be when it is a veteran crossing campus in a wheelchair, having lost an arm, an eye, and 2 legs? How much stronger will our temptation be to have the veteran just fade away from our vision by averting our gaze? The Veterans Administration is currently reporting that approximately 30% of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines returning from the combat actions interestingly named the Global War on Terror, that 30% of them are reporting mental health problems. 30%. Now, in a military culture in which suck it up and drive on is a mantra, I am willing to bet that there are many more who are suffering from mental illness and spiritual crisis than are ever willing to report it to the VA and have it end up on their military records. Because that affects your career. Promotions are affected by that. No one knows how many Iraqis and Afghanis have been killed, but the number has to be, in the hundreds of thousands, if you include combat operations, sectarian warfare, and disease. 5,275 American service members have been killed in the combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Several of those killed have been my friends, including Captain Travis Patchiquin, a native of Lockport, Illinois, and my roommate and military partner when we were both privates in the Army in the early 1990s. As disturbing as these numbers are, as deep as the need to care for these families is, these numbers pale in comparison with another. It's a difficult figure to track, but some reports have it that over 25,000 American service members have been wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan permanently. Some track that number as above 75,000. Many of these have been injured seriously enough to require evacuation from Iraq, with lost limbs or severe head trauma. It is wonderful that due to the miracles of modern medicine, more service members are surviving combat wounds than ever have before. But the miracle of their living means that we must care for them after they have come home. Many of those who would have died on the field of combat in Vietnam are living today, and so many more of them are going to be with us for the decades to come. I believe, however, that the crisis we are seeing in how we care for the physical needs of our veterans is the lesser of our problems. That the mental and indeed spiritual crisis that we will see in the lives of our veterans and their families, and I believe in the life of this country over the coming decades, will be much, much more profound. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought about a new phenomena in the cycle of military conflict and warfare, and that is the cycle of repeated deployments. Dr. Jeannie Douglas, a psychologist who is the director of the Veterans Center in Oak Park, Illinois, made this complication clear to me one day. In prior wars, when a service member came home, they were home. they were not likely to be sent back. This allowed the person to begin the spiritual work of recovering from the horrific sights and sounds and smells of war. They were able to begin the process of reintegrating with society, with their families, of forgiving themselves, of forgiving others, and of beginning the long road to finding out what a new normal might feel like again. Today, when a service member comes home, there is no guarantee that they are going to be able to stay home. Far from it. For the first time in living memory, service members are spending more time deployed than they are at home. When a service member returns to their home and family, it is likely that around a year later they will be redeployed to a combat zone, whether they're active duty, National Guard, or reserve. There's a certain mental mindset that someone needs to survive in combat. The military calls this mindset battle mind. It is a hypersensitivity, an ability to change emotional states very quickly, a kind of task-oriented focus that does not translate well into the civilian world. The kind of attention to authority that combat requires does not relate well to raising children. The kind of task-oriented relationship building that combat requires does not make for healthy marriages. The kind of constant awareness of threats that combat requires does not make for safe drivers on local highways. The kind of swift, brutal, efficient reaction to threats that combat requires does not have a place when someone pushes you in a crowded bar here in Madison. Not being able to make that switch from battle mind to civilian mind is more common and just as profound as post-traumatic stress disorder. For me, upon returning home from Bosnia, it was about 12 months before I quit looking for landmines in the road, quit yelling out the window at my fellow drivers, quit driving like I was in NASCAR, and quit getting into fights for no apparent reason. Now imagine if when I came home, I knew I'd be heading back in 12 months. It took me that long to begin acting and thinking like a civilian again. And my experience of war was light compared to those that have seen the real combat and horrors in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dr. Douglas told me that it would be irresponsible for psychologists today to begin the real work of helping our service members to mentally come home if in the middle of that work, when they're at their most vulnerable, we order them to put their uniforms back on and send them back into combat. So what they are doing is, to use a hospice term, palliative. They are trying to hold them together so they can go back, not solve the problem. And trauma is laid upon trauma is laid upon trauma. As traumatic as the effects of repeated deployments are on service members, imagine the hell they create in the lives of families, in the upbringing of children. Families that barely survive one deployment, only to have the service member come home and be unable to connect, unable to break out of that battle mind to the point that they can reform relationships with their children, with their partner, with their spouse. Often those relationships do not survive the second deployment. The rate of divorce in the military is rising dramatically. In some units, upwards of 90%, along with the rates of suicide among service members and their families. I am painting this picture because I want you to understand what I mean when I say that I believe that the national spiritual crisis we're going to encounter in the next 10 years in the wake of these wars will be unlike anything we have ever seen before. Whether you know it or not, we are all connected by no more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation from someone who has served in Iraq or Afghanistan. We see this anxiety in the increase of violent television shows. We see this anxiety in the increase of the wear of camouflage clothing by civilians, in the popularity of huge SUVs, even in light of gas prices. We are trying, sometimes obviously, sometimes subconsciously, to find ways to feel safe in an increasingly unsafe feeling world. Even if we could turn our eyes away from the physically wounded veterans returning from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places, and indeed around the world, there is no way that the effects of the spiritually wounded veterans and their families will just fade away. The effects of this war are felt so far away as on the streets of Madison, as well as Paducah, Kentucky, and Bakersfield, California, and Brownsville, Texas. And that anxiety has, in some ways, infected the rest of the world. It was that same anxiety, and in some ways the guilt, that went along with it, that caused all those students to look away from me when they saw me crossing campus in my uniform. The only person who spoke to me was a construction worker who yelled at me, "Kill them all!" I said, "I'm a chaplain." He said, "Sorry, Father." And even with all of this, I still believe there is hope. There is always hope, because try as we might to ruin it, this world still abounds with compassion. This world still abounds with good people, with good hearts who have learned to love. Not romantic love, although that happens, but the kind of love that is meant by the word agape, that still exists within the relationships that we build as human beings. It is the kind of love we speak of in our covenant as the spirit of the churches of liberal faith in this movement. It is that kind of love that calls us not to look away. No matter what their relationship to you, no matter what you might think of whatever war they fought in, to look in their eyes and say, "Welcome home," even if you can't say thank you. I have been on both sides of that kind of greeting, both giving and receiving, and in both my heart swelled and tears came to my eyes, as two people connected on a level not of anxiety and fear, but of love and hope. It is the kind of love that lets them talk with their preconceptions down and lets us listen with our preconceptions down and truly learn from each other's experience, as we actually listen to our veterans. Those who have been to war have so much to teach us about peace. I am also given hope by the way that soldiers reacted during the recent shooting of over 40 service members and military civilians at Fort Hood in Texas last Thursday. We do not know why Major Nadal Malik Hassan chose to open fire at a soldier readiness center, but I suspect that years of listening to the stories of soldiers struggling with their own combat stress had something to do with it. But where my hope comes from is how the soldiers responded in the aftermath of that shooting. They ripped off their uniforms and they began emergency medical treatment, using their shirts and jackets to make bandages for the wounded. Others took to closing doors and securing the buildings around the shooting. Some even gave, and I can't think of a better example of inherent worth and dignity than this, some even gave medical help and assistance to the shooter. And they saved his life as well. Now they are coming together as a community, caring for one another, supporting one another. Among those soldiers providing support to the Fort Hood community is Chaplain Captain the Reverend George Tiger, the fellow Unitarian Universalist who was with me at Chaplain Vernon Chandler's retirement ceremony. there are tons of things that we, as a liberal faith, can do and that we should do to prepare for this coming spiritual crisis. We are called to redefine once again our movement in light of our commitment to be welcoming, our commitment to a kind of radical hospitality. Our religious movement has learned to be welcoming before, when we opened our movement and our ministry to those who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. Many thought doing so was a dangerous idea because it meant that what it meant to be a Unitarian Universalist at the time would change. And they were right. We did change. We are a different movement today than we were when GLBT ministers fought their way into our ministry, and when we joined to welcome gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender persons into our congregations. And I believe that because they have joined us, it has made us a deeper, richer, and better movement than we were before. In the coming spiritual crisis, I believe that we Unitarian Universalists must learn to be welcoming all over again. I believe that we must learn to listen to our veterans, not just from Iraq and Afghanistan, but from all wars, because I guarantee you there are veterans in our churches from World War II, from Vietnam, many of them silent about their military past. I believe we need to empower the veterans who have already fought their way into our congregations to tell us their stories so that we can learn from them. I believe we need to empower these UU veterans to their own ministries of outreach among the veterans coming home from our current set of wars and from the wars that are sure to come in the future, though I pray they don't. To reach out to them with our message of liberal faith, of compassion, of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, but also with listening ears and open hearts, to listen without our own preconceptions about war to those veterans, to allow their stories, their wisdom, to teach us how we can better create peace. Doing so will change us as a religious movement. But without the kind of change that comes from adding new experiences to who we are, we cease to be a religious movement and we become a religious stagnant. The church where I served as the intern minister, the Unitarian Church of Evanston, has already begun this kind of welcoming ministry and is, I believe, an example congregation to the rest of our religious movement. By supporting the Great Lakes Military Ministry Project, which is our outreach to the sailors at the Great Lakes Naval Station, they are helping young Navy recruits know our saving message of hope, of interconnection, and of inherent human worth at the beginning of their time in the military, before they've gone to combat, to know that message. I only found it after. Congregations in San Diego and Norfolk, Virginia, have begun their own outreach programs to service members and veterans, and the Church of the Larger Fellowship is developing currently a workshop to prepare congregations for this work of welcoming. The Unitarian Universalist Church of Birmingham, Alabama, will be the first church to go through this program next weekend. Add to this that the UUA will be publishing soon our first book of meditations for service members since World War II in the next few months. This has come about through donations from around the association of over $25,000, and 10,000 copies will be distributed free of charge to the military through our military chaplains. This congregation here, I believe, has also begun that path. For I challenge you to think of how you can be more welcoming of military service members and families in the Madison area. For as our congregations begin building these welcoming bridges to physically and spiritually wounded veterans and their families, our movement's military chaplains will do the same work with service members before they leave the service, spreading a gospel of hope, of universal love, of human dignity, and most importantly, with the idea that we can all find personally transforming power by being part of a beloved community. no matter who you are, or what you have done, or what guilt you carry, our faith says that you still have inherent worth. You are still interconnected with all. And that you can become more than you were before. If there is a better treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't know what it is. That we are all, as Chaplain George Tiger has said, we are all perfectly imperfect. It is my hope that when time comes for Chaplain Cynthia Kane, Chaplain Rebecca Montgomery, Chaplain George Tiger, Chaplain Kolani Kasela, Chaplain candidates such as myself, Shannon Holland, and the other 9 chaplain candidates of our denomination currently, that when the time comes for us to take off our uniforms, the religious movement of Unitarian Universalism will welcome us as veterans and will allow us to find healing and hope in this, our beloved community. As our beloved community will have, by then, learned to do the same for all of the veterans who walk through our doors. So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.
And David is going to do our closing words.
Agatha Christie once said that one is left with the horrible feeling that war settles nothing, that to win a war is as disastrous as to lose one. I say to go forth from this place dedicated to the ideal of radical hospitality, an ideal not of seeking equality, but of a willingness to be humble enough to put aside your preconceptions and truly meet others by being in service to them. And with that ideal, bless the world. Go forth in peace, creating peace. Amen.